listening to an episode of The Rewind, a podcast series by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This episode features audio from our event on September 29th, 2023. This event was a partnership event between our Peter C. Cook Leadership Academy's Wheelhouse Talk series and the Frederick Meyer Honors College Fall Lecture Series. Together, they brought in Faye Richardson Green to share about her life and her story and about a framework called culture mapping, which can be used to deepen our understanding of ourselves and others. It was a fantastic presentation, and I'm really excited for you to listen to it. Faye also recorded an Off the Stage podcast episode with me, Maddie Miller, and it was filled with cool stories and awesome advice. So please be sure to check that one out as well, and that'll be linked in the description below. All right, let's roll the rewind.
I do want to thank the Hauenstein Center and the Cook Leadership Academy for this partnership. It really does make a good match, and we're very happy to collaborate, so thank you very much. I also want to thank the Meyer Foundation for its support of the Frederick Meyer Honors College, of course, but also this series, but also other aspects of the university like the Fred Meyer Center for Writing and West Michigan Authors, which supports our student writers in developing their skills, but also supports and celebrates West Michigan writers locally and nationally known West Michigan writers. We have the Meyer Office of Fellowships here on campus, which helps students pursue international opportunities. And we have the Meyer Endowed Chair for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, which started in 2012. And our speaker tonight, Faye Richardson Green, is the fourth of those endowed chairs. Part of the job of the endowed chair is to teach a class. And Faye, this semester, is teaching a class called Leading Others in an Othering World. And I think that kind of signals part of what she'll be talking about tonight. We did put together a brief biography that Faye had produced earlier, and it is on that sheet of paper. And if you don't have that, it's in the back table here, but I just wanted to, as opposed to reading through the biography, I thought I would just tell you a little bit about how we got in touch with Faye and why we're here tonight. It was actually close to a year ago when my colleague, Dr. Melba Velez-Ortiz, who teaches classes in the ethics and value of listening as a skill, was looking for speakers for her first year sequence. And she saw a profile in West Michigan Woman. And Faye was the title story, the profile of the magazine. And the title of that piece was, I want to get it right, listening serves us well. And so Melba thought, great, great match. So she gave Faye a call. And when Melba described the class that she teaches to Faye, and I never got the exact quote, but Faye said something like, you sound like my kind of teacher. You're the kind of person I would like to get to know. So she came in and did visit the class, and that's got us started. I should say that it's not that easy, and I guess it's partly because it's part of my job to find these Meyer Endowed Chairs for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. It's not that easy to find people who have been very successful in the business world who also have an interest in or a talent for teaching or experience with teaching. So Faye, as you see in her biography, has not been a professor or a teacher in the past, but she has been involved in certainly in facilitation and in leading others and in training and in engaging a variety of people in the community. And I've been delighted so far, and I'm sure it'll continue, I've been delighted in how Faye has embraced the job of teaching a seminar in leading others in an othering world. And I know that class is going well so far, and I'm sure we have some students here tonight from there, and we're looking forward to several more years with Faye as part of our team. I guess that's all I really want to say. I think we'll find that what Faye has to say is very relevant to our world right now, our campus right now, and so I'm really looking forward to hearing it. So let me introduce Faye Richardson Green. Thank you.
So first of all, I want to do the formal piece. I want to thank Dr. Gillis, the Brooks College of Interdisciplinary Studies Leadership, the Meyer Foundation, the Hohenstein Center, and the Peter Cook Leadership Academy. I hope I haven't missed anybody in that alphabet, but I wanted to say thank you. I am so delighted to be here. I have a special shout out for Dr. Ortiz. I don't know if any of you students have participated in her class yet, but she is this ball of energy and passion to beat the band. And I don't know how anybody ever says no to her. I said yes to talking to a class. How I ended up here is anybody's guess. That woman is good. For those of you who haven't met her, you just have to. She is just so loving and passionate and energetic. So when I was asked to speak a bunch of months ago, the easy part was saying yes, because I had months to figure out what I was going to talk about. Well, more recently, somebody said, Faye, we really need to get on paper what you're going to talk about. And I went, now we're at the hard part. So I'm like, well, what do other people do? So I said, well, I can talk about me, that I know. And I can talk a little bit about me relative to two topics that are of interest to me and passion for me, and they are around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and leadership development. So hopefully what I have to say is worth your time and effort to be here tonight. I thought that I would do this presentation using a tool that some in the audience might be familiar with. I've used it with for-profit learning audiences and not-for-profit learning audiences. It's called a cultural map. It is not a scientific piece. So if you're looking for a research-driven instrument that I am sharing with you, that you can say this has been stamped by some expert, you are going to be disappointed. This is simply a tool that I have found very helpful to get learners to start to do introspection and really begin to learn more about where some of their worldviews have come from. And so I thought a great way to use the tool to introduce it to you and to help you learn a bit more about me is to bring my story into this tool. Now, the tool itself really tries to help identify the myriad of influences that impact the way that you think about the world. And so it could be your race, your ethnicity, your faith. It could be your geography, where you were born, where you spent the greatest part of your life. My husband's a veteran. It could be association with the military. It could be that you're an athlete. So what are those significant groups that you have been affiliated with that really have influenced or marked the person that you are and or are becoming? So these associations are also the ways in which you learn lessons, gain and or deepen values, or develop beliefs. And so when I use the tool with learners, I am asking them to identify these significant groups and also now to take the time to think through what are the key lessons, values, or beliefs that have surfaced as a result of your association to that group. So I'm going to share with you my map, my journey, my story. So this is what the map looks like. It's a very simplistic map. This one has 12 circles. 12 is an arbitrary number. It makes it easier to direct people because once this thing is completed, the individual reflects on it and then they spend time sharing with others. Ultimately, they learn where there are similarities and where there may be differences around some of these circles of influence. And some of the lessons that people learn from the activity is that, boy, we had very different experiences noted here, very different influences, and yet we have gained the same value or belief. So it becomes an extremely useful tool. So here are some of the groups that I have identified as key for me. Going around the circle, what you see is my race, my gender. I have first, normally I put what looks like 1/5 because I am the oldest of five. I was born in the South. My parents are from the South. I am heavily influenced by that Southern root. I oftentimes talk about, I am absolutely delighted that my parents immigrated from the state of Mississippi to the great state of Michigan. I think that single act made a tremendous difference in the quality of life that I have been able to have and the character of the influences that have surrounded me. I share characteristics, customs, behaviors with people who are married. I'll say more about that later. I grew up in the city. I have a younger brother who grew up in a much more rural environment because my parents moved from the city of Grand Rapids to someplace near the city of Hudsonville, out in the, you know, God's country there someplace. And my brother had a different lived experience than I did. That's what I'll say about that. I am a parent and grandparent. I also am very deeply involved in the greater Grand Rapids community as what I call a community steward. I also am a learner. I have a learner mindset. I'm one of the most curious people that you'll ever meet, to the point that my mother used to get very upset with me because I was her child that would go, "But why? But why?" Now, one of the things that some of y'all might know is about black mamas. You ask a question one more time than you should. If you ask me why one more time, I am going to knock you into next week. Now, I've always wondered how one gets knocked into next week, but I also was smart enough to stop with the next why, so I never had to learn. But that's how curious I am. I am a Christian by faith identity. I am also a traveler, and I am a retiree. And so my associations in all of those, I share characteristics with other people who are retirees, other people who identify as Christian, others that identify as black. I am not gonna talk about every circle, but I did think that I would share a few that have had the most profound effect on me. When I use this with learning groups, we have everybody talk about all of them. And then when I was doing anti-racism work, I would ask them to identify the influence that had the most profound impact on their beliefs, values, and attitudes associated with race. In the class that I'm doing now, I asked them to do that same association with othering, you know, not belonging, discriminatory behavior. So I find it just extremely useful to have people think deeply in that way. So I am going to start with the first circle at the 12 o'clock position. It's my race. And I would say that the circle that has had the most profound impact on who I am has been about my race. And so I want to tell you a couple of stories because it will help to explain the key values, lessons, and beliefs that are mine as a result. Now, I don't know if my mother remembers this, but there are a couple of childhood instances that have had a very deep and profound effect on me. When I was roughly 8, again, I was born in the South, my family's from the South, we used to travel to Mississippi a lot. One of the things that I did not realize until I was an adult is that one of the reasons that we did these 20-hour travel, no hotel stops, no restaurant stops, none of that, was because it was not safe for Black people driving in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s back and forth from Michigan to Mississippi. And so we'd have, you know, the car packed with food and those sorts of things. But we still had to stop periodically to use the restroom. And so in someplace in southern Illinois, we pulled into a service station, and I'm the oldest of 5. And I have a middle sister that's 3 years younger than me and a baby sister who is 5 years younger than I am. We pull into this service station. My job is to get myself and my sisters into the restroom and back into the car in one piece. I am the oldest of 5. I am extremely responsible at the threat of life. So I do my job. We go into the bathroom. I'm the oldest, so I get to go first. And while we are in there, a middle-aged white woman comes in, took one look at us in there as I'm moving my sisters into the restroom, and she, "What are y'all niggas doing in there? This is not for you. This is for white people. Your bathroom is around the corner. Get out of here." I'm the oldest of 5. I know how to comply with the rules. And so I grabbed my sisters, went around to the back, and there's this door hanging off the hinges. It is dirty. Somebody had once painted it white, but you could barely see that. There's a sign above it that says colored. And I look at the sign, and I look at the door, and I go, "Who are colored people, and why would they want to use this nasty restroom?" So, because I didn't know, I went around to my mother and I said, told her what happened and that this lady told us we had to use, and the look on her face was pure horror. But she hurried up, got us into the car, got us up the road someplace, and my sisters still had to go to the bathroom. They still had to urinate. So what she did was Daddy pulled off, they opened the doors, created a couple of walls of privacy, and my sisters were able to use the bathroom. That instance stuck with me because I didn't understand why I couldn't use the bathroom. What was wrong with me? I don't get that. The second instance happened when I was going from 6th to 7th grade. In Grand Rapids, some brilliant man developed something called the Coleman Plan, which is interesting because my maiden name is Coleman. But this plan was designed to move black children out of city neighborhoods, whether they were integrated or not, to suburban areas. It, over time, became what happened with Union High School when high school students were moved. But the first time they bused kids, the pilot was a bunch of seventh graders from my part of the city to Harrison Park. I wasn't sure about going because that was moving us out of our neighborhood. There were a number of parents who wanted to keep children in their neighborhood schools. It was the one time that I saw my mother politically, socially active, trying to help keep us in school. It never worked. They bussed us. And it seemed okay for a little bit until the day we came out of school and there were parents and older youth lining the sidewalk from the front of the school to the bus with signs that had racial slurs on them. They were rattling chains, waving knives, and telling us that we did not belong. I was terrified. Yet again, what is wrong with me that people don't want me and people that look like me in these places? What I learned from that is being black must be bad. I'm going to have to work really hard for people to recognize who I am. The last instance that had a profound impact on me, I was an adult working professionally, and I had a senior executive say to me, "You're articulate." Yeah. Okay. Yes, I am. But what he said that really struck me was, "You are really a credit to your race." And my response was, "No, I'm a credit to my parents." Again, the message was that there's something wrong, and because I exhibited some behavior differently, then I must be unique and an exception. And so those instances are what provided me with the impetus to get involved in diversity, equity, and inclusion work. It began with anti-racism work, and it was anti-racism work that was designed around maintaining the integrity of the people who wanted to have these discussions. There is a book called Racism in America by Nathan Rutstein. He is Baha'i. And the Baha'i started these dialogues on race that morphed into these Institutes for Healing Racism. I became a facilitator with that because I was committed to helping people understand that people that looked like me, people that were other persons of color, did have value, did make differences, and that it wasn't all about negative, and all you had to do was get to know people who look like me. And with the leading others in an othering world, that is just one characteristic that I want you as students, these other students, to understand that until you can confront and face the biases embedded in some of your cultural influences, you cannot start to understand and truly lead a very diverse personage in a very diverse workplace. Another area that has been very significant for me is the one I'm calling first. I'm first born. Our family was the first Black family in an all-white neighborhood. I'm also the first in my extended family to go to college, right? So how did that happen? Because my parents had to quit school early because they had to work. They had to help support their families in various ways. And so Upward Bound became the lifesaver for me. How many of you are familiar with Upward Bound program? So several in here. Upward Bound was a program designed to assist youth who were first to go to college with the resources, the knowledge, the expertise that they needed to be able to go to college and not be behind those who come from families where college was just an expectation and a tradition. In Upward Bound, and this is one where being a first and my color kind of meshed, Upward Bound took us on a Southern historically Black college tour. I didn't know that there were historically Black colleges until Upward Bound told us about them. So that's one thing. I'm a smart kid who was very interested in going to college, but when you don't know things exist, then you don't do the kinds of things you need to bring those things into your life. So anyway, we go on this tour. We went to Meharry Medical College in the state of Tennessee. We go down to Georgia. We go to Clark University. We go to Spelman, Morehouse. For those of you that don't know, Spelman is an all-female college. Morehouse is right across the driveway, and it's an all-male college. I decided I was going to Spelman. My daddy said, no, you ain't. And it was because he was worried about me being so far away from home. But the thing that happened on this trip that for me fundamentally changed the direction of my life is they took us on a bus tour of a wealthy area in Atlanta. Now, I had never met a wealthy Black person in my life. So, I mean, I don't remember, you know, sports figures making big bucks like they do now. Movie stars were in a whole nother world, and I don't even remember really that many Black movie stars. But this is a neighborhood where homes are huge, cars are, you mean Black people can make a lot of money? I'm going to be one of them people. And so it acted as a trigger, a motivator for me, even beyond my love of learning, to go to college, to work hard as I could, to be able to live in a house like that in order to have income like that. What I learned is that having role models matters. I was a role model for my siblings and for some others, but Upward Bound provided me with all kinds of role models that looked like me. And the benefit for me was that those role models counteracted those other messages that I was getting about how awful it was to be the color that I am, how awful it was to look like somebody. I now had a sense of hope. I now had vision for the future. And I knew that I was going to be successful and succeed. The third circle that I want to talk about, I want to talk about one really briefly, and then I'll talk about this other one. The circle I want to talk about is the one about parent and grandparent. Now, some of you are much luckier than I am. Y'all fall in love with some person, and you know what love is all about. Now, I've been in love. I've been married once or twice. maybe three times. And a couple of times it didn't work out. So I decided I would just keep trying until I could make it work. But what I discovered is that when I became a parent, I now knew for the first time what unconditional love really was about. The first time I saw my birth child opened me up in ways that I cannot describe. My ability to love that child opened me up in ways that I became able to adopt. I am a birth mother, an adoptive mother, I've been a foster mother, and I'm a stepmother. I learned from parenting what it means to truly love. And so that is the value that I gained from becoming a parent. The next circle that I want to talk about is the community steward one, because it kind of meshes a lot of things together. I have been volunteering in this community since I was about 10 or 11. My first volunteer was as a tutor for a profoundly deaf child. After that, I taught swimming to five-year-olds at the YWCA, and I never went in the water because I can't swim worth a darn. But I'm a good teacher, you know. I don't do it, but I could teach it. And so I did that. And then at 14, I was, now I'm old, so some of you will never have heard this term before, but I was a candy striper for the Red Cross. And I have a friend here who, besides my mother, is the person I've known the longest in the whole world. Her younger sister and I are the same age. And so we both were candy stripers together. And we worked at a couple of different nursing homes. I will tell you that we both were happy to do things like read to the residents, help write letters, and that sort of thing. But because they didn't have adequate staff, they also used us in ways that they shouldn't. They had us serving meals. They had us in parts of the facility that we really, as 14-year-olds, really shouldn't have been in. The thing that I learned from that experience was that my parents would never go to a nursing center. My friend learned the same thing, and I can say that when one of her parents became someone who needed additional nursing care, those girls got together in a way that kept their mom at home. And if I ever got into that same situation, that was the pledge that I made. Now, I know that a lot of nursing and care facilities have changed over time, but at 14, that was the impression that I was left with. I also, as part of Upward Bound, got involved in parent-teacher-student councils. I have done additional tutoring. I have been on more boards than I can even remember, but one volunteer activity that, again, was a life changer for me was when I came out. So I'm going to tell you a story that sort of is relevant, I guess. When I came out of college, I was going to be a reporter, right? I was going to jump on TV 8 or 13 or something. No jobs. So I ended up being hired into a leadership training program at Old Camp Bank. And because I didn't know much about banking, because I didn't get a business degree, I'm a communications major, I decided I needed some supplemental business classes. So I went to Davenport College, and one night I went into the bathroom, and there was this sign on the door that said they were looking for volunteers for the Kent County Rape Crisis Team. And I thought, that sounds interesting. I might learn something, and I might be able to help people. I'm the oldest of five. I know how to be my brother's keeper. And so I made the phone call, went through the training, And the training was designed as an empathic listening skills event. And that's what we used when we encountered children, mostly children and women, who had been sexually assaulted in Kent County. And so I got pretty good at that skill. Well, there was a sister organization called Switchboard. It used to be that there had to be a 24-hour crisis helpline available in community, and Switchboard was that for the greater Grand Rapids area. And so the Rape Crisis Team and Switchboard combined, and so I then became a part of this Rape Crisis Switchboard 24 crisis, and the crisis dealt with suicides, divorces, any kind of crisis that you could think of that somebody was dealing with. Switchboard responded to it by phone. I loved being a part of Switchboard and the Rape Crisis Team so much because I really felt like I was doing a service for our community, that I decided I wanted to be a trainer and train volunteers to be able to do this skill. And so I became a member of the training team, and some of my past co-facilitators are here in the room too. And I then became a trainer of trainers. Now, I tell you this story because the thing that I learned two things from being a facilitator. I learned the value of listening completely, taking myself out of the conversation, and truly being present for another individual. And then the other thing that was much harder for me to learn, but has served me very well, is that feedback is a gift. Now, when you're getting feedback, it doesn't feel like a gift. But what it did is it helped me learn how to shut up and hear criticisms, however delivered, without being defensive. The third thing that I learned is how to be and listen non-judgmentally. Those three characteristics are characteristics that I have brought into my leadership style. I know how to listen effectively. I know how to listen caringly. I know how to listen non-judgmentally. And I know how to listen non-defensively. What I learned from my bosses over the years, that particular set of capabilities set me apart from other leaders that were in the organizations that I participated with. And as I have mentored, as I have coached other leaders, those three qualities have always been part of the blend. And so the passion around diversity, equity, and inclusion comes from knowing what it feels like to be isolated, to be othered in ways that are not true to who I really am, comes from spending time helping people who are interested become allies, become anti-discriminatory, whether it's race, whether it's age, whether it is sexual orientation, gender identity, it really doesn't matter. There are ways that all of us can challenge ourselves to resist our own biases, prejudices, and stereotypes in a way that will help others feel welcomed and wanted, not isolated and as if they don't belong. It is especially critical when you are in a leader role that you take a look at self first. A quote that has served me well over the years is by an author, James Baldwin. He said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." I believe that in leader development, the first thing that anyone who aspires to leadership has to do is look at themselves first. What are my values? What are my beliefs? What are the lessons that I have learned? And how are those values, lessons, and beliefs showing up when I am in a leader role? Especially when I am leading someone who is fundamentally different in some way than I am. How do I set aside those values, lessons, and beliefs, not get rid of things that I really value, but how do I set them aside in a way that will contribute to the effectiveness of the team as opposed to diminish the effectiveness of the team? And so one of the things that I will tell you about diversity, equity, inclusion, et cetera, and leadership, that really, really, really helped me. And that is, I was fortunate at Steelcase, because that was the company that I left most recently, to have leaders who were willing to set aside their own biases in such a way that they could hear me, support me as, at one point in the company, director of organizational effectiveness and inclusion, which is really another way of saying diversity, equity, and inclusion. But the emphasis was on organizational effectiveness. It was not on diverse characteristics. I don't know if that makes sense, but that was what we were driving for. So we wanted to make sure that whatever characteristics you brought to the workplace, if they were adding value to the work, we wanted to make sure that we had systems that were set up to recognize and honor the value you bring without diminishing you based on any characteristics that you might have, especially if they were characteristics that were different than statistical majorities within the company. Leadership is about people. Leadership is not about tasks. And so I hope that in the few minutes that I have been talking, that you have gained from me what my leadership philosophy is and the ways in which I try to walk it, talk it, and help other people do it as well. Thank you, and I appreciate you coming and listening to my story.
So I first want to start off with, you are an amazing speaker. The way you storytell is so powerful, and I just want to say thank you for letting us hear that. I am curious, though. I think we didn't really get to dive in much into like the leadership roles you've held. So I'm interested in, what is one leadership story you have that you think helped you develop as a leader the most? And I know that's a little bit of a toughie, so you can take your time with it.
So most of the leadership roles I've had have been on the administrative sides of organizations. And I have been team lead, supervisor, manager, director. I've been with a local group, and I left the company as a global leader. I probably grew tremendously when I took on a global leader role, because I had to really expand my own capabilities in terms of thinking through, if I'm working with a team in Asia or a team in Europe, what adjustments do I need to make besides to time? Because I also had to be available sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning or midnight, but it was that learning how to best operate within a global environment. The other place that was pretty challenging for me is I took a developmental assignment in manufacturing. I have never worked in a plant in my life. The one time during college that I wanted to be a plant worker to make some money, I flunked the test because you had to be able to put these pieces together. And they said, I'm sorry, but you lack manual dexterity. So this is the story of how I went into manufacturing. Is it okay if I tell the story? Okay, so I had been the director of organizational effectiveness and inclusion for a couple of years, and we were doing some real movement in the company, and I had a strategic plan, and there were things that I had active. Well, there was a senior vice president for manufacturing who had been working with me on some things and really liked what I was doing and decided that my skill set should influence manufacturing. And I should be influenced by manufacturing because Steelcase is at its core a manufacturing company, so that as I continue to move in the company, I would have this meld of my own personal development, but I'd also be giving to the company. Well, we had a little bit of a disagreement, and I said, I'm so looking forward to this opportunity, but I think it is like six months to 12 months too soon. We've got some things that are really at a precarious point. And this was a lesson for me. He said to me, I understand, but Faye, I've worked really hard to put this together for you. Now, any of you that have worked in environments that understands politics, he just very smoothly said to me, if you say no to this, you won't do anything else in this company. And so what I said was, this is great. When do I get to go? And that's how I ended up in manufacturing. I spent 5 years. It was the best assignment that I ever took. I learned that in manufacturing environments, and maybe it's because it's a male-dominated environment, position matters. People tend to be a bit more straightforward with you. You can be straightforward with them. And so from a learning perspective, I gained even more in my own toolkit. So when I went back on the administrative side and became director of the Global Learning and Development Group, I had tools that I didn't have when I left. So, yeah, you're welcome.
We do have a couple questions from Zoom here, too, that I would also love to pepper in. One individual asked, did you feel that assimilation was needed to gain different opportunities throughout your career? And if so, do you still feel the need to assimilate?
So I don't think that I've ever assimilated into anything. I'm pretty authentic. I'm pretty direct. I'm pretty clear. I do know when to shut up, but I don't think that I've ever assimilated, and I don't think assimilation is required. I think that people need to know how to read the room. I think people need to understand what is being asked of them. And as we have even greater diversity in our workplaces, I think assimilation is going to be even less likely. And I think that more and more leaders are going to need to figure out how to leverage the talents and capabilities and manage around some of those personal characteristic challenges that they might encounter. I hope that answers your question.
Hi, so my question is, how do you, or how did you learn to, overcome personal life challenges.
Personal what challenges?
Personal life challenges.
Well, there's a couple of ways that I have dealt with personal life challenges. I have had some friends that have been accessible, so that has helped me. I also am not shy to say that I have had therapy. And I, again, I like to address things head on. And so I'm willing to talk things through with people. If they are not, then I find somebody that will help me kind of just get clarity, get it out of, you know, get it out of my brain. But yeah, therapy, good support systems, and addressing things much more head on. Thank you for that question, too.
Another question from Zoom. This individual asked, in your closing remarks, you said leadership is about people, not about tasks. How do you recommend leaders stay on track and maintain their focus on people-centric leadership, especially when faced with numerous tasks and responsibilities that may sometimes divert their attention?
So you have to have people who can accomplish the tasks. So part of the challenge is identifying the talent and inviting the talent. And this is going to sound maybe too touchy-feely, I don't know. But you invite the talent to do the work as opposed to demand that the work drives the talent. So if you have people that are capable of assembling widgets, you figure out what do they need to continue the process of assembling the widgets. And if there is a barrier of some sort, as a leader, your job is to clear the weeds. It's to eliminate the barriers, so that they can do the task. So the leader is focused on the people and what the people need to accomplish the task. The leader wants to make sure that there are the appropriate resources, the appropriate tools, the appropriate time, and that they are present when things get difficult. When I was a bank branch manager, I always had a window that I could jump into when my staff got slammed. When I worked in manufacturing, I was a plant superintendent, which meant I had several factory areas that were my responsibility. But I had no shame in doing panel assembly or running a machine, as long as it wasn't a press, because I didn't want to lose any body parts because I wasn't really trained to do that. But I jumped in to say that there isn't a job here that is beneath me. I also never stayed in my office. There were times I had to be in office, had to be in meetings, but when I didn't, I was with people, so that they knew that I was their supporter, that I had their back. A couple of times I had to fall on my sword to protect my team from, in one instance, I had a fairly, what I believe to be, abusive boss. And I did not want my team to suffer from this person who I believe to be truly abusive. And I did everything I could to act as a barrier between them and this person so that they never took a direct hit.
We have one more on Zoom if nobody in the room has one. How have you built trust with the people that you work with, both professionally and in your crisis volunteer work?
I almost wish you could ask one of them. So actually, through a lot of what I've already talked about. Listening genuinely, inquiring respectfully, being non-judgmental, being available, being willing to be challenged, not having to be right or the smartest one in the room, I think are all things that I've done over the years with various teams, both with colleagues, peers, and direct reports that have helped to build an environment of trust.
Listening to an episode of The Rewind, a podcast series by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies. The audio for this episode was captured by Mark Washburn of Gyrus Media. This episode was produced and sound engineered by Maddie Miller. The Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University is inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service and is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, the Peter C. Cook Leadership Academy, or the Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and recurring initiatives, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review and rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening.